Forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge,
or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast, now part of the Finding Genius Foundation. And today my guest is Theo Fleury. He's a previous ice hockey player, and he's become an expert in the field of relational trauma, which we'll get into. So, Theo, thank you for coming.
Yeah, my pleasure, man.
If you would, tell me, so you played hockey for a while. What's your background? How did it turn into, unfortunately, working with people that have trauma? I would guess you experienced it yourself, unfortunately, but what's your background?
Yeah, so, you know, I grew up very poor as a kid, and, you know, both my parents struggled with their own trauma, which manifests itself into addiction as a coping mechanism. And so I grew up in that environment. And then, you know, as a way for me to cope, you know, I discovered hockey at a very early age, which, you know, allowed me not to be at home. It allowed me to be in an environment where, you know, I was getting some nurturing and being instilled with some great values. And then as a phenom adolescent hockey player, I ran into a coach that basically promised me a one-way ticket to the NHL. And over a 2.5 year period, I was raped by this man 150 times, which,
oh my God,
you know, which obviously, you know, caused me to, you know, have a lot of shame, a lot of guilt, a lot of anger, a lot of resentment, and, you know, that turned into, you know, mental illness.
Well, tell me, so what was the progression of feelings like? Did you feel shame at first, or like, how did this progress to become what you're saying is mental illness? Like, what happened first and next, what was the experience like?
Well, I believe that every single person on the planet who's experienced trauma, and trauma, you know, it doesn't have to be as extreme as my trauma, but, you know, trauma is what brings us into the mental health space and into the addiction space, right? Because when we're traumatized, what happens is our nervous system, you know, basically, you know, gets thrown out of whack because of, you know, the amount of cortisol and adrenaline that is attached with, you know, experiencing whatever kind of trauma that is. And so, and what I know about cortisol is like acid in your body. And so what I was left with was, you know, dealing with the aftermath, which was terror, which was fear, which was questioning a lot of things about myself. And so, you know, I lived in a high stress environment. My body lived in a high stress environment. And so, you know, cortisol, which is a chemical in our body, you know, when we're in fear or we're stressed, you know, produces this chemical, which is not good for our bodies. And so, you know, this is where I lived the majority of my life, was in that state of, you know, fight or flight or, you know, response.
So my wife has, you know, she had a very difficult childhood and it had made her hypervigilant.
Yep.
I mean, depression, stuff like that.
One of the gifts of experiencing trauma is, you know, you have this built-in radar now, you know, to protect yourself. You know, I can walk into a room and within probably a millisecond know who all the safe people are and know who all the unsafe people are.
Really? What kind of feelings do you get from people that correlates with that?
Well, it's just hypervigilance. It's just part of my system. It's like a, you know, involuntary reaction. Because when you grow up and you don't feel safe, you know, you develop this innate ability to know how to be safe.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. But I don't have this ability, it sounds like you do. So what happens when you walk into a room? What kind of cues would tell you that someone's safe or not?
I just know. I don't know how it happened, but I just know.
Oh, really? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I've met people where, you know, where there's been a few people I met where I literally sensed evil emanating from them, which was really weird. Yeah. And thank God it was incredibly rare, but I guess I don't have the ability that you've developed.
Right. Well, it's, you know, it's a survival mechanism, right? You know, I think
it makes total sense.
I think all of us, you know, have that ability. You know, mine's just a little more defined than everybody else because of my experience.
What happened after, you know, this that guy traumatized you X number of times when it was about to happen again? What was different about your reaction, and what was the breaking point?
Well, any kind of sexual deviance is all related to power, right? So this guy had power over me. You know, I had a dream from probably the first time I ever put on a pair of skates that I wanted to eventually someday play in the National Hockey League. And so this guy held my whole entire career in the palm of his hands. And so there was a certain amount of power that was involved in the situation, right? And so I either go along with it, or, you know, I create a conflict where, you know, 30 some odd years ago when it happened, nobody was talking about sexual abuse. And so, you know, first and foremost, I knew I wouldn't be believed. And then secondly, I knew that that would be the end of my hockey career, because I would be branded as a troublemaker and, you know, a liar and all this stuff. And so I just kept it inside. And it wasn't too long after that that I discovered alcohol and drugs as a, you know, a coping mechanism to suppress the emotional pain and suffering that I was experiencing. And then, and like I said, you know, 30 years ago, nobody was talking about mental illness. And so what do? You know, I grew up in the suck it up era, right? Yep. And so there was no place to put this.
Were you done with hockey, or was this person still running your life, essentially, or were you finished?
No, he left after the 2 years. I was with him for 2.5 years. He got fired by the team that I was playing on, and then I didn't have any contact with him after that. But what I was left with was a lot of fucking bullshit, you know, that wasn't my fault, that I had to deal with, right? And 16, 17 years ago, I had a fully loaded pistol in my mouth ready to pull the trigger and my life, not because I wanted to die, but I was exhausted from living the emotional pain for the majority of my life, right? But that was the catalyst that pushed me into, you know, a place of finally taking a look at it and finally, you know, putting it in its rightful place, which was the past, so that I could move on and live life on life's terms without substance, without addiction, all those things, right?
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on support us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click support us today. Now back to the show.
Someone, I had gone to a office where they do ketamine infusions, and on the wall they have anxiety, depression, and PTSD. And they say like everyone is kind of a mix of those three.
Yep.
And some people seem to have more of one than another. Are you able to characterize what your particular bent was, and what did that mean for you? Like, were you more anxious than depressed, or were you more stressed than anxious?
I have all three. I have depression, I have anxiety, panic disorder, and PTSD.
Right.
All three. Yeah.
What kind of techniques have you figured out over the years to help yourself?
I have tried absolutely every single therapy known to mankind.
So what did it take for you to heal yourself, or you to feel better? Like, are you just managing these problems still, or do you feel like you've truly overcome them?
Well, I have the way I coped before, I had a toolbox full of addiction, right? Alcohol, drugs, food, sex, gambling, work, you know, all of it. And basically what I've done is I've taken out the addiction and I've replaced it with holistic practices. So meditation, yoga, breathing exercises, EMDR, Equine therapy, you know, you name it, you know. And because I'm, you know, I'm a curious guy, I like to learn. And obviously, you know, being an advocate and an activist in the space of, you know, mental health and trauma and addiction, you know, I need to be educated. And the only way I know how to be educated is to actually try as many things as possible so that when people come to me, I can say, hey, have you tried this? Have you tried that? Have you tried that? Right. So when you're talking the talk, you need to walk the walk as well. But, you know, what's come out of it is, you know, healing, right? You know, and it's a three, you know, it's a three pronged thing, right? It's emotional, it's physical, and it's spiritual healing, right? And if you do something every day for your emotional health, your physical health, and your spiritual health, you're going to be okay.
So did all these different methodologies of treatment, did any of them work or did none of them work?
All of them worked. All of them worked. All together, they all worked, right? And what it, what it allowed me to do is fill up my toolbox.
Oh, because usually people say, I've tried everything and nothing works, but I guess what I don't know if this is the right characterization. So each thing helped you maybe a few percent and all of them together got you to back to health.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Some modalities were better than others, but, you know, I think all of them together, definitely, you know, made a difference. And, but, you know, I don't understand, you know, the comment, I've tried everything and I'm not better.
What do people mean when they say that versus you? Like, again, you mean something different, but what have you observed people mean when they say that?
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
Well, trying and actually doing the work are two different things. And with me, you know, I do the work, which means...
So you think...
Which means I get to a place of vulnerability where I actually talk about... You know, it doesn't bother me anymore to tell people I was raped 150 times. Like, it doesn't bother me, you know, doesn't have any trigger or emotion. Nothing is attached to that, you know, and that means I've done the work that you need to do, right?
Like, what if I were to say some people try everything, other people work at everything.
Yeah.
And the people that work at everything are the ones that get results.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the old saying, the harder I work, the luckier I get, right? Therapy is hard work. Like, it's hard work. It's uncomfortable. It's not fun, but it's necessary in the process if you want to heal.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
If you were to go back in time to when you first started looking into all these modalities, would you rearrange them? Would you not do certain ones or do certain ones first?
No, because my spirituality tells me that God has a plan for me and has always had a plan for me. And these things present themselves when I am ready to do the work.
So, I mean, in your journey back to mental and, you know, mental and physical health, well, really mental health, what were the bumps along the way that maybe looking back in hindsight, like, would you have cleared them away or you did it in exactly the right way that you should have done it?
There's no perfect way to do this. But there are also 10,000 different ways to heal, right? And are you willing to try everything possible to heal? Yeah, I'm one of those people. But yeah, you always go into new experiences, you know, with this certain amount of fear. But how do you get through fear? Well, you walk through it. And, you know, when you get to the other side and you look back and you go, you know, that wasn't as bad as, you know, my head made it out to be, which tells me, you know, there has to be a certain amount of willingness, you know, on people's part. And, you know, part of the process of healing is you're going to sit in, you know, negative emotions and negative feelings, and it's not going to feel great, but it's part of the process. And I think that's why people go into therapeutic processes and they stop because they're uncomfortable sitting in those uncomfortable emotions. Mm. In my experience is, you know, just go the distance, right? Go the distance. And I guarantee at the end of the experience of sitting in a negative emotions, like that's why, you know, addiction is a part of mental illness is because when we can't cope with the emotions and the negative feelings and negative emotions, we're going to go to our coping mechanisms so that we don't have to sit in those uncomfortable feelings. But true healing happens when you sit in negative emotions and negative feelings.
What's an example of that, of sitting in them, like you described?
Well, sadness, frustration, anger.
Yeah, let's say I felt really sad and hopeless. Like, yep. What would I do normally versus what would I do to sit in it and to help myself through it? Like, what can you put words to that on how someone would do it the right versus the wrong way, let's say?
Well, the right way is to pick up the phone and talk to somebody. You know, that's the right way to do it and say, you know, I'm really sad today. And you talk it out, right? That's the only way you're going to release that emotion is by talking about it. And the longer you sit in it, you know, the harder it is. Because who wants to sit in sadness? But everybody does. Why? Because there's stigma attached to negative emotions. I can't talk about this stuff because people don't want to hear it, right? And therein lies why we have, you know, why mental illness or mental health challenges is the biggest epidemic on the planet, is because we haven't created safe spaces for people to talk about negative emotions or negative events that happen in our life. People don't want to hear it.
I can see, like, I went through many years ago, you know, it was over a relationship, which it was what it was, but, you know, I was depressed for a bit and I could see pretty quickly, like, you know, people don't want to be around you because they just don't want to hear it after a certain point, you know? So how do you help yourself and reach out to people, but not burden them and constantly be like, I'm depressed, I'm anxious, and just kind of suck the life out of them? How do you still be a father, mother, friend, lover, whatever to people, but deal with this as well?
Yeah, well, relationships are hard. You know, there has to be a certain amount of vulnerability, and there also has to be compassion. There also has to be empathy. There also has to be forgiveness. And those are things we're not taught. We're taught to suppress emotions, suppress feelings, you know, all the time, because it's, you know, it's just part of, you know, sort of the world that we live in. But the people who get vulnerable, get, you know, honest, you know, are the people that make the biggest strides. Because if you don't release that stuff, it ends up getting stored in your body, right? And
but what and if I met you years ago when you were in the middle of this, and you know, and
you would have met you would have met the angriest guy on the planet.
Wow. What would you have said to me though if I said, come on, Theo, you know, you're all right, or what if I tried to help you either in a good way or
I wasn't ready for help.
How would you have reacted, you guess? Just you would have pushed me away or whoever that tried to help
you? I would have blown you off because I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to deal with what I needed to deal with, right?
So what do you do with someone you care about that you could see they're having a problem, they're suffering, but they're saying, leave me alone, I don't want to talk about it, or they're pushing you out? What can you do?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is, you know, I see that you're struggling, and I just want you to know that when you're ready to get some help, that I'm going to be here for you. That's all you can do. Here's a great example. So addicts and alcoholics and sex addicts and you name it, gamblers, you know, we're really good at collecting enablers, because the more enablers we have, the longer our behavior can last. But eventually we make all the enablers sick because of our behavior. And so they end up having to go get help for themselves. And then eventually we're left with no enablers, and then we're left to our own defenses, which then it helps us hit the proverbial rock bottom.
And so people it makes sense. They'll push away, let's say, the healthier people, and they'll hang out with the ones that don't push them and don't question them. But those people themselves fall out. And then at some point you're alone and you're at rock bottom.
Yep. That's how it works. You know, that's, I see it almost every day in my practice, and what I do is the people that eventually come to me are at a rock bottom place, or, you know, families of enablers call me and we do an intervention. We do an intervention on the addict, but also I'm also suggesting to the enablers that they need to go get help too, so that everybody can go their separate ways, go get healthy, and then come back, repair the relationship.
So you have to wait till someone hits rock bottom before they're willing to listen to you, or because you have had problems yourself?
Well, I know people that are ready for help, and I know people that aren't ready for help.
But what do you do if you're in relation with someone, or you know someone that's not ready for help, but they're really making it very difficult for you to do what you do?
Then I put boundaries in, because if I have boundaries, then I'm not going to get hurt.
Oh, what are some examples of good boundaries that you've heard from yourself or other people?
Well, everybody's boundaries are different.
I know they're all different, but any examples of a boundary that worked well?
If you do this, if you continue to do this, I will do this. I won't have anything to do with you.
It makes sense.
Which is kind of harsh, but you know, I'm the one that continually gets hurt because your behavior. So, you know, I need to put in healthy boundaries so I don't get hurt. That's basically what boundaries are. And it's all based on behavior.
You know, earlier on, in a way, you're like a superhero because you went through a terrible thing and you now have enhanced abilities. Mm-hmm. Like you said, the hypervigilance. Do you think that's instrumental in you helping to, or knowing when someone needs help versus not?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a certain amount of intuitiveness that I have. There's a certain amount of hypervigilance I have. There's, you know, there's things that are unexplainable, you know, that makes me sort of a great helper in this space is, you know, I can see stuff. But, you know, the bottom line is if the person doesn't want help, there is nothing you can do to change that. They have to experience and hit, you know, the proverbial rock bottom, whatever that looks like, on their own. And
yeah,
that's the frustrating part of you know, doing this work is meeting with people who I know need help.
So
but they're just not
ready.
What
does your practice look like? Like, what, you know, when do you help people? How do you help them? What's the nuance of it?
Well, I'm an author, so I write books on the subject. I'm a speaker. I'm a facilitator. I'm a life coach, all those things. So, you know, most of the requests that come in are not from the actual people who need help, but they're from parents and grandmas and grandpas and aunts and uncles who see their loved one going down the wrong path.
Yeah, it must be incredibly hard. You know, when the person's not ready to receive help and I just tell them
straight out, you're not ready for help. And when you're ready, you know, I'll be here. I'm not going anywhere.
How do people react when you say that? Do they go, okay, or does it stop them in their tracks?
Yeah, it stops them in their tracks because it's the first realization that, you know, my time is valuable, right? My time is valuable and I'm not interested in trying to convince you that you need help.
What does your practice look like though? When someone comes to you, like what are some of the activities you do in your practice?
Well, I'll do an assessment to see if they actually want help, you know, and if there's even a little bit of willingness, yeah, then I'll work with them. And then, you know, it's just getting them to come up with their own plan, right? Not my plan, their plan. And then me holding them to account to the plan that they made for themselves.
Are there certain traumas that are much more difficult to treat than others?
No, trauma is trauma. Emotional pain is emotional pain. Oh. There is
no that's bar. Good. It would be terrible.
There is no bar. That were very difficult. There is no bar. Everybody feels emotional pain exactly the same way. It's not about the experience. It's about finding the gift in the trauma that allows them to overcome the, you know, emotional damage that they've experienced. And a lot of people don't see it as a gift. I see my struggle as a gift because without the experience, I'm not talking to Richard Jacobs on Zoom right now. You wouldn't have a clue who I was. If I didn't talk about
a simpler level, like the gift was the hypervigilance. The gift was, you know, being able to read situations and people better.
The gift is resilience. Adversity teaches us and gives us resilience. And then once we have resilience, there isn't anything we can't get through.
Okay. Okay. So do you tell that to people? Like,
look, yeah, absolutely.
You've been through hell. You made it. So therefore, like, you've been more resilient than most folks. So celebrate that, I guess, or at least take comfort in that.
That's the gift. That's why God gives us these challenges, because he needs us to have resilience. And
that's a pretty cool way of looking at it. I like
and the people right now who are struggling the most with COVID and lockdowns and all those people don't have resilience. And that's why they're struggling.
Very interesting.
If you experience trauma and you're still here, you have resilience. Because if you didn't have resilience, you wouldn't be here.
That's really cool. That I could see stopping someone in their tracks early on too.
And I also tell people, you know, do you have a time machine? And they look at me like, why does this guy ask me if I have a time machine? I go, because you can't change the past. But you can certainly change the future.
I would think that's a very empowering thing to tell people, like, you're here. That means you have resilience. That's really cool.
Yeah. This stuff isn't rocket science. You know, we tend to make it like that, but it's just simple relationship. It's connecting with somebody on a spiritual level that can take you through the process of healing.
You know, you mentioned a couple of times that you have faith, but what happens when you deal with someone that is an atheist, or they haven't even considered that, or they're mad at God?
Everybody gets triggered by the word God. I don't subscribe to the white bearded guy in the sky. I don't subscribe to that theory. But what is spirituality? To me, spirituality is a relationship. The relationship I have with myself is the most important one, but it's also the one that I neglected the most at the beginning of this process, right? And so if I have a great relationship with myself, I love myself, take care of myself, eat well, sleep well, exercise, go to therapy, do meditation, then if I have a good relationship with myself, how do you think all my other relationships are going to be? Great. They're going to be the same. But if I'm angry, resentful, pissed off, that's what I'm going to project. And who wants to have a relationship with a guy who's fucking angry and pissed off all the time?
Yeah, no, it's true. There's days where I've been agitated, and every, you know, I go to the coffee shop, I think the person's a jerk, what's probably me being a jerk, and I try not to bring it home. But and days when I feel really good, all my relationships are better. So I realize, like, I affect everyone around me, and I have to be careful not to affect them negatively.
It always comes back to you. All of this stuff always comes back to you, right? Has absolutely nothing to do with anything else other than, you know, am I spiritually well? Am I emotionally well? Am I physically well? That's what it's all about. And you control that, not anybody else. You control. You control how you feel. And you get to choose to be nice, kind, compassionate, empathetic, or you choose to be an asshole. That has nothing to do with anybody other than yourself.
But what if someone feels totally out of control and their emotions are in control of them, and you say that to them? Wouldn't they push that idea away? Like, how could that be? I feel this. I feel that. I'm filled with anxiety. I'm filled with this. What do you say to someone like that?
Well, you need to do more work. You need to figure out why you feel this way.
Okay. Yeah, makes sense. What kind of emotional problems are you seeing lately from people? Has it changed over the time you've been doing therapy with people? Or,
no, you know, again, what are the biggest traumas? It's just basic stuff. It's either depression, anxiety, you know, the more extreme people, you know, PTSD, OCD, personality disorder, you know, those need a little bit more compassion and empathy. But, you know, general anxiety and general depression, it's a choice. You need to acquire tools that help you get out of it. And they're simple things. You know, it's not, you know, sit down and, you know, do a breathing meditation for 10 minutes. I guarantee you'll feel better. You know, same with anxiety, same with, and then PTSD, you know, you need to find modalities that are going to help you get rid of the movie that continually plays in your head. That's what PTSD is.
Oh, I don't know much about PTSD. What movie is playing in people's heads? Like, what do people experience with that?
The trauma movie, right?
Okay, like someone they know when war was blown up, and they keep seeing that over and over.
Yeah. And for me, it was, you know, laying in the cot in the dark room waiting to be molested. That was my post-traumatic stress, which happened every night, right? Because I got to go to sleep every night.
Right.
So how do you get that image out of your head? Well, it takes work. It takes special therapy to get rid of that. But I also know that the brain is, you know, neuroplastic, which means I can change. I can rewire my brain.
I guess people have to hit rock bottom in order to seek help. Or have you seen that some people will seek it before they get that bad?
Yeah, not necessarily everybody needs to hit rock bottom. You know, I think we put too much emphasis on that, you know. But, you know, like I said, you know, that's something that's out of our control. I wish, you know, if I could, you know, if I could go out and you know, just get people not to hit rock bottom, you know, I'd be a billionaire. Everybody's on their own path. Everybody has their own plan. And you know, the interesting thing about lessons is, you know, the universe will keep putting a lesson in front of us until we get it. And sometimes we're not ready for the lesson and it goes, but it comes back.
So is there any resistance in your practice? Do people just say, I'm ready, and they come to you? Or do you have to do any convincing? And if you have to, that means they're not ready. What's it like for a new customer to start working with you?
Everybody's different, you know, everybody's different in their process, right? Some people get it right away. Some people, you know, are slow, you know, or afraid. And other people are, you know, resistant to it. You know, that's where I have to be, you know, I just have to be willing. I have to be patient sometimes. I have to be more loving. Sometimes I have to be more firm. You know, it all depends on the person. But I guarantee you, when the light bulb goes off, you got them forever. They're not going to leave.
What advice do you have to someone that's living with someone that, you know, has significant depression or anxiety or PTSD, and life's not easy? It's really difficult, you know, living with this person or knowing this person. What are some techniques to help fix things?
The bottom line is the only person you can change is yourself. Like I said, when the person doesn't want help, you can fucking jump up and down and scream and yell and do everything you can. If that person doesn't want help, they don't want help, and there's nothing you can do. I know it's a harsh way to put it, but it's the most honest way of putting it as well. Go look after yourself.
Well, what do you do? Like, let's say you're, you're married to someone for a few years, and now you see they're just like incredibly depressed and anxious and this and that, and they're just mean to you every day, and they're, you know, they're just down all the time, and you never know who you're going to get. It's like Jekyll and Hyde. What do you do in that situation?
Well, I see that you're struggling. I see that you having trouble with life right now. I just want you to know that I'm here to help. I'm not here to enable. I'm here to help. And I suggest that you maybe should go talk to somebody, because I'm not, you know, I don't have the skill to be able to help you through whatever you need help with. But I'm also going to go get some help so that I can better manage your, you know, your illness. It's as simple as that.
Okay. Like,
you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And that's what I see in the mental health space is, well, first of all, there's so much stigma attached to mental health that prevents people from getting the help that they need, because they're afraid of judgment. They're afraid of ridicule. They're afraid of, you know, the fingers being pointed at them. You know, they're getting messages like, why don't you just get over it? Da-da-da-da-da, right? So that's the stigma attached to wanting help, right? And so, you know, I'm an advocate and an activist in this space. What do I do all day long? I fight stigma. That's the biggest challenge I have, is fighting stigma. So
stigma from what? The people in that person's life that are...
The space of mental illness has the worst stigma attached to it. And that's what causes people not to get help.
What are some of the reasons people say that they don't want to get help? Is it they feel embarrassed, or they're not ready to confront it? Yeah. Or what is it?
They're embarrassed. They're, you know, they're afraid of judgment. It's all fear-based stuff.
Okay.
And we have not created a space in society where mental health is 100% fully accepted as the biggest epidemic on the planet. It's not acknowledged that way. And, you know, we've done a really poor job creating safe spaces and safe environments, right? And there's not, and to be honest with you, there's not enough skill on the planet to deal with the amount of mental illness. There's not enough skill.
What have you seen since, you know, the Corona stuff happened? Has it accelerated and gotten a lot worse? Or
yeah, like 100 times worse. Why? Because you locked us down. You've limited my movement. You've taken away church. You've taken away community. You've taken away all those things. And so what am I left with? I'm left with sitting in my house inside of my own head. And in the mental health space, that's the worst place you can be, is inside your head. That's why suicides are spiking. That's why opioid addiction is spiking. That's why, you know, mental illness is spiking, is because the basic thing that we need is relationship. Yeah. And if you don't have relationship, you're going to struggle. It's just as simple as that.
Have you worked with people in different countries that have been locked down for different periods of time, or just people in general that have? And is there a point at which someone's like, this is a new source of trauma for them, or is it always a new source of trauma?
Well, everybody has trauma.
Yep.
And now COVID has added another layer of trauma. So yeah, that's why it is at a crisis level, is because, like I said, the mental health system on the whole entire planet has been run over, because like I said, there's not enough skill. There's not enough people for the amount of help that needs to happen. And I don't know if that's by design, but you know, for example, I live in a province in Canada called Alberta, and they gave $100 million to mental illness. And you know, we have 4 million people that live in this province. Divide that by 100 million, and basically that's $4 per person to go get help. Can you get help for your mental illness for $4? Will a therapist see you for $4?
No.
No.
Yeah, no, I don't mean to laugh at it, but yeah.
It's fucking ridiculous, right? It's ridiculous. But, yeah. You know, we're giving $100 million to mental health. Well, it's not going to do anything.
Yeah, it sounds good, right? But it's spread out over nothing, yeah.
Yeah.
Theo, where can you help people? Do they have to be in Canada or Alberta, or can they be worldwide?
Worldwide. So during COVID, I created a program called Trauma Transformation, which is on my website. TheoFleury.life is my website. And the people who take my course, I run a group, a therapy group online twice a month. As soon as you sign up for the program, it automatically gives you access to our group that we do. And so we have like 200 members, and we meet twice a month. And it's an amazing group of people who, you know, we're all healing together. We're all sharing. We're all vulnerable. We're all, you know, working on our stuff. And it's amazing to be a part of it. And I'm honored that I get to co-facilitate a bunch of people who are really, you know, looking to overcome whatever they need to overcome.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. Do you feel like this group therapy helps people heal a lot faster than just one-on-one type situations?
It's the most effective, cheapest kind of therapy on the planet.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Because it doesn't cost anything. All it costs you is your time. Show up.
Do you charge for this, or is it free?
It's a very small nominal fee just for the administration, but other than that, doesn't cost much.
Okay. One more time, that URL again, please.
TheoFleury.life.
Okay. And Fleury is F-L-E-U-R-Y.
Yep. And then I have a foundation here in Calgary too, where we do, you know, we do group therapy twice a month as well. And I co-facilitate that as well. So.
Oh, excellent. Well, very good. Theo, thank you for coming and for your raw, brutal honesty and your tough love. I appreciate it. Listeners will like it too, you know?
Well, it's tough love with a lot of compassion and empathy in it, right? You know, I grew up in the tough love era, right? And as much as caused some damage in my life, I really think it can be effective too, you know, done properly. But it is love, right? It is love. It is connection. It is, you know, sometimes you need tough love. Other times you don't need it. You need more compassion, need more empathy, you know, these kind of things, right? So I've had a lot of experience and I know what works and I know what doesn't work. And so I stick to with what works. And nine times out of 10, it's just conversation and connection.
Excellent.
Well, Theo, what's the opposite of addiction? Connection.
The opposite of addiction is connection?
Yeah. Huh. Get connected.
All right. Well, very good. Theo, a lot of wisdom here. I'm not saying as much as I normally would because I'm like, you're giving me a lot of, of good bumper sticker type things to think about. So I appreciate it. Yeah.
Well, like I said, you know, I've been in this space for a long time and I know what works and I know what doesn't work. So, and it's the people, you know, it's the people that I work with that have educated me. The people that I'm trying to help, you know, have helped me more than I've helped them. And I think that's important too.
Well, Theo, very good. Thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius Podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at FindingGeniusPodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.